Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 366. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about wreck dives, sailing ships, and live volcanoes as we go to Vanuatu. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's episode, I do have three news stories for you. If your car needed a tow, you wouldn't be surprised if the tow truck operator charged you. Those same rules don't seem to apply at sea because Carnival Cruise Line is telling a U.S. senator that no, they don't have any intention of paying the bills for the 90 different serious events involving Carnival ships that needed Coast Guard help over the last 5 years. And for just the last two, the Carnival Triumph and the Carnival Splendor incidents, the bill comes to $4.2 million. I mentioned last week that Frommer's guidebooks were no longer going to be available in print. Turns out that may not be true. Google has sold the brand back to Arthur Frommer. Frommer hasn't actually owned the brand for a number of years. And then in an interesting but somewhat inevitable turn of events, Samoa Air has figured out that heavier passengers cost more than lighter passengers, and they are now going to charge you based on how much you weigh. Some of the Samoans that I've known might be paying a pretty penny, so what I've been doing recently isn't so much dieting as saving on future airfare. For links to all three of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. This episode of Amateur Traveler is sponsored by Viator. I was checking to see whether they have any tours in Vanuatu, but they don't. But I did find that for my next trip, which is scheduled to be to Toronto to the TBEX conference, I can save $45 on the cost of a city pass. To see what savings you can find at Viator, go to amateurtraveler.com/tours. It is my great pleasure to welcome back to the show Chris Willis. Chris has been on the show we came up with five times, doing five of my favorite episodes of The Amateur Traveler. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I'm really happy to be back.
And the five episodes that we came up with were, in somewhat in order, Swimming with Whales in Tonga, the Stone Churches of Ethiopia, the Mountain Gorillas in Uganda, the Wild Horses in Mongolia, and lots of wildlife on the way to and from Antarctica.
That's right.
And one of the themes that we may see there is that you, both you and your wife, as I recall, enjoy photographing wildlife.
We do. It's one of our biggest hobbies, and we plan a lot of our trips around the opportunity to take wildlife pictures.
And we're talking today about some place that people may have to look up on a map, and that is Vanuatu.
Right. Whenever I tell people that that's where I went, they always ask, where is that? And so I try to explain to them that Vanuatu is in the very far western South Pacific. It's between Fiji on one side and New Caledonia on the other, almost all the way out to Australia. And it's directly south of the Solomon Islands also.
And I think you named at least two other places that probably most people can't put on a map. So
just go follow the equator almost all the way west till you're almost to Australia, and that's where Vanuatu is.
Excellent. And why did you go to Vanuatu?
So there were several things that coincided to get us interested in traveling there. First of all, several years ago, the TV series Survivor filmed a season there in Vanuatu. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting highlights of the season was they took the contestants who won some sort of challenge to see an active volcano that's there in Vanuatu. And they got to stand right near the volcano and see all the lava coming out of it. And I thought, gosh, that is really cool. And I'd really like to go do that someday. So I always remembered from seeing on that TV show that there was this volcano there. The other thing that coincided to get us traveling there was my wife knows that I have this dream of sailing in the South Pacific. And there is a particular boat that does sailing tours among many of the islands in the South Pacific. It does sort of a circular route every year. And at the time of year that we were ready to travel, it happened to be in Vanuatu. And so that coincided with our interest in seeing the volcano and got us to go there.
And you say a particular boat. Which boat are we talking about?
It's a ship called the Soren Larsen. It's a sailing ship, and it moves almost entirely under sail power. It's rigged as a brigantine, and it's about 120 feet long, carries a crew of about 14 and maybe 17 or 18 passengers. And it's based out of New Zealand, and every season they do a circular route where they leave New Zealand, they go all the way out to French Polynesia, and then make their way back to New Zealand through all the intervening islands of the South Pacific over the next several months.
And you're testing me here, but a brigantine, I know that a brig had a large front sail and a large back sail. It was a square sailing vessel, but I don't know what a brigantine is.
It's the same thing. Okay. It's a two-masted ship. It's square rigged on the front, and it has a fore and aft mast in the back.
Excellent. Okay. I think I passed that test then. All right.
Yeah, well, you know more about it than I do, or at least knew more than I knew before I got on the ship.
Excellent. So tell us more about your trip to Vanuatu. So you did some of this trip on the ship.
Correct. 10 days of it was on the ship, okay. And that involved sailing from Espiritu Santo Island north to a group of islands called the Banks Islands. We spent a couple of days on Santo first. I did some diving there at two really incredible dive sites, and then we took the ship from there.
Okay. And what should we see? If we were to retrace your steps, what are the highlights of the trip?
Well, certainly at the beginning of the trip, Santo is very famous for its diving. Mm-hmm. And the reason that it's famous for diving is because it was the site of a very significant U.S. military base during World War II. It was the base that was built to support the Solomon Islands campaign. Mm-hmm. Vanuatu is the closest set of islands to the Solomons. So Santo Island had six airstrips, three for fighters, three for bombers, a huge Navy base with a naval dry dock and ship repair facilities and all of that. It had an army hospital, a huge garrison that would hold hundreds of thousands of troops. And so a lot of the attractions of the island are themed around the former U.S. military presence there. In particular, there are two really spectacular dive sites that are very easily accessible from the island. One of them is the shipwreck that I dove twice called the SS President Coolidge. So the Coolidge was built in the 30s as a luxury passenger liner, and it ran a Pacific route, San Francisco to Tokyo, for a number of years. It's a huge ship. It's 653 feet long, 22,000 tons. Hmm. And at the beginning of the war, the Army bought the ship and converted it into a troop transport capable of carrying 5,400 troops. And it had these huge cargo bays that they could carry a lot of material as well, ammunition, guns, vehicles, things like that. So the Coolidge was on its way into the base at Vanuatu on Santo Island, and unbeknownst to the captain of the Coolidge, the Navy had mined every approach to the harbor except one. And the skipper of the ship got into the vicinity of the base and was worried that there might be Japanese submarines lingering about. And so he proceeded to enter the harbor as quickly as he could. The ship was capable of about 20 knots, so he came hauling into the harbor at about 20 knots, straight through one of the minefields. The guys on the shore started furiously signaling him to get him to stop, but by that time it was too late because the forward momentum of the ship, he simply couldn't stop. He got the order out to reverse the engines and immediately hit the first mine after that, and just a few seconds later hit another mine. They both hit on the port side of the ship. The captain realized what was happening, so he attempted to beach the ship to prevent it from sinking because he had 5,400 men on board. So he turned into the shore, and remember, he's already in the harbor at this point, turned into the shore but ran the nose up on a reef so wasn't able to completely beach the ship. The ship took about 90 minutes to sink, during which time almost everybody was evacuated off. There were only 3 casualties out of over 5,000 men on the ship. He got everybody off, and the whole wreck was very well documented because he's sitting there in the harbor in the middle of a U.S. military base. So there's pictures of everything. There's detailed logs of what happened. And of course, all the men who jumped over the side merely had to swim about 100 feet, and then they were up on the shore. So no one was lost at sea, fortunately. However, the 2 big holes in the ship caused by the mines ultimately filled with water. She listed over on her port side, slid off the reef, and sank right there in the harbor, basically fully intact. So the ship is sitting there with the nose being the closest part to the shore, and it's only about 150 feet from the beach. So you do it as a shore dive. The nose is the shallowest part. It's 70 feet, and the stern goes all the way down to about 200. So if you're not breathing specialty gas, which I'm not, you dive the forward third of the ship down to about 110 feet. And I dove it twice that day. And it's truly one of the most spectacular dives I've ever done. And it's commonly rated as one of the top 10 wreck dives in the entire world because the wreck is completely intact. It's like a huge 3-dimensional underwater playground because the ship is so huge and there's so much stuff still in the ship. The forward cargo holds still have jeeps and tanker trucks and self-propelled artillery pieces in them. There are racks of rifles, helmets, gas masks, rifle ammunition. There are shells still in the ammunition boxes of the 3-inch and 5-inch guns on the decks. There is medical supplies, cutlery. There's a typewriter. All of this stuff is still on the wreck, and it makes discovering the wreck and exploring it very, very interesting. The other really great dive site that's just a few hundred feet down the shore from where the Coolidge is called Million Dollar Point, and it has its own very interesting story. When the U.S. vacated the base in 1946, they had tons of equipment, bulldozers, trucks, jeeps, all kinds of sort of moving equipment that was used in building and maintaining the bases there. And they decided that they would negotiate with the locals to sell it to them. The locals took a gamble and decided to not offer very much money for all that equipment, thinking that the U.S. would just leave it there anyway because they didn't want to pay the expense of transporting it all back to the United States. Well, the American commander who was involved decided to teach them a lesson. And so what he did was there was a pier there right off of the shore, and he drove all the equipment off the pier and into the water at this place that's now called Million Dollar Point because supposedly $1 million worth of bulldozers and trucks and other vehicles was driven off the pier there. So you dive it and it's this slope and there's just huge piles of bulldozers and tanker trucks and other vehicles that have been sitting down there since 1946. And it's a really, really interesting dive site.
Interesting.
So that was really the first highlight of the trip was the opportunity to dive the Coolidge and Million Dollar Point. And then we were boarding the ship to go on a cruise of the northern group of islands in Vanuatu called the Banks Islands, which themselves have a very interesting history. You've probably heard of the Mutiny on the Bounty, right?
Sure.
So the Banks Islands are unique among South Pacific Islands because they were not discovered by Captain Cook when he went through and first surveyed the islands. He discovered all the islands from Santo south, but did not see or chart the Banks Islands. They did not appear on the British Admiralty's charts as a reason for that. So here's what happened. When the Mutiny on the Bounty occurred, it occurred off of one of the islands in Tonga.
Right.
Captain Bligh and some of his men were put off in one of the lifeboats from the Bounty. And what most people don't know is that Bligh was a master navigator. He had actually trained under Captain Cook and had been on one of Captain Cook's prior journeys. So from memory, without the benefit of his charts or any navigational equipment, Captain Bligh plotted a course to get themselves from Tonga all the way to Timor, which is in modern-day Indonesia. The thing is, he wanted to stay far away from land because in the western South Pacific, the Melanesian natives of those islands were known to be very hostile. So he didn't want to get close to land and risk being attacked by the indigenous inhabitants of the islands. So he plotted a course north of Santo, thinking he would just be going through open ocean. Instead, he happened through this series of islands, the Banks Islands. He observed and noted them in his logbook from the Bounty's lifeboat and finally made his way to Timor. A couple of years later, he was given command of another expedition on another ship called the Providence. It was called the Second Breadfruit Expedition because the purpose was to transport breadfruit trees from Tahiti to the Caribbean islands to be food for slaves that were being held there. And so he decided to swing back through these islands that he had seen from the lifeboat of the Bounty, chart them, and name them. The sponsor for this voyage was Sir Joseph Banks, and so he named the islands the Banks Islands after the sponsor of his trip.
Hmm. You know, I knew he was a very good navigator. I didn't realize they hadn't given him any charts, though, too.
I don't believe they did. And he did it from memory, from my recall, and it's an amazing feat of navigation. And then, of course, he discovered these islands by happenstance along the way. Hmm. And they still bear the name that he gave them so many years ago. And so the Banks Islands are a series of fairly small islands in the northern part of Vanuatu that are very remote. They typically don't have organized towns or cities. All the structures that would be there would be bamboo huts, essentially, and the people there live essentially cut off from the rest of the world. They might get a supply ship in every 6 months or so, but they really do live in as authentic a way as possible in terms of how the natives of those islands lived before, not colonization, but rather discovery by European explorers. And so it's interesting to just be sailing past these islands, and the only sign of humanity you might see is a little bit of smoke coming up between the trees where somebody has a fire, or a couple of dugout canoes that are sitting there on the shore of the ocean.
Hmm.
So we toured these islands, visited them, did a lot of great snorkeling, visited a lot of the villages, and essentially went to some of the remote areas on the planet. And some of the islands are very unique. So, for example, one of the islands that we visited is a place called Uriparapara. And the island itself is a volcanic cone where one side of it has collapsed down and opened the center into the sea. So if you look at the island from overhead, it looks like a big letter C with a huge bay in the middle of it formed by the remnants of the volcanic cone. And Captain Bly actually had some very interesting comments about it when he charted the island on the second breadfruit expedition. And it makes for a very interesting destination because of the very unique shape of the island.
Okay. It reminds me of Santorini from your description.
Yeah, and all these islands are volcanic. Vanuatu is near a very significant subduction zone. Mm-hmm. And so it has, I believe, 13 active volcanoes, and all the islands are volcanic in origin. And they're also some of the most seismically active places in the world. Vanuatu averages getting a magnitude 4 or 5 earthquake about 3 times a week, and they have a magnitude 7 about once every 3 months.
Hmm. That's impressive even for a guy who's sitting here in California.
Right. It is an incredibly active fault, and it's responsible for all this earthquake activity plus all the active volcanoes that are still present in the islands. And some of the islands have beautiful scenery. So one of the places that we stopped was a place called Twin Waterfall Bay, and it has this spectacular twin waterfall that's about 50 or 60 feet high that has this thunderous flow over it and a little lake at the bottom of it. And we had a great time photographing that, swimming in the lake under it, etc. And just in general, seeing the very unique Melanesian culture that's preserved there in Vanuatu and the subsistence lifestyle that people are living. They have to grow their own food or catch it out of the ocean. They're not sitting there being supplied by supermarkets or anything like that because they don't have electricity. They don't have regular communication or even supplies coming in from any place else. So they have to live essentially as they've lived for thousands of years.
Hmm.
So after that part of the trip, we came back to Santo for a day or so and stayed at a beautiful resort called Oyster Island. Oyster Island is on the eastern side of Santo, very close to where one of the U.S. Army Air Force fighter airstrips used to be. And one of the interesting attractions of being near Oyster Island is it has a wrecked American fighter plane in the water that you can snorkel to. It's in shallow enough water that you can actually snorkel to it. Because having a fighter base that close, obviously somebody didn't quite make it in one day and crashed in the ocean just a few hundred feet off the shore. And it's a beautiful resort, but still very secluded. And it has a very interesting river near it where you can kayak up the river and go to a place called the Blue Hole, which is a place where there's a spring that just comes up out of the limestone, and it's this beautiful light blue color because of the shade of the rocks that are involved at the spring, and it's this spring that feeds the river that then goes down into the sea. And it was a really interesting day trip to do.
Hmm.
So from there, we had another objective for the trip, and that took us to an island called Epi, E-P-I. And Epi was probably the most remote of the areas that we went on the trip. Epi is an island that most tourists don't go to. The airport on Epi consists of a big area of grass and a little shack, essentially. And okay. That's all there is to it. It's the most rudimentary airport I've ever encountered. And I've been to a lot of places with grass airstrips. So we flew into Epi and stayed at a guest house called the Epi Island Guest House, which is essentially the home of an Australian couple who decided to basically go off the grid and live on their own on this very remote island in Vanuatu. So they have a house near the airport on Epi Island. They have some extra rooms, and so they let people stay with them. The wife of the couple, her name is Alex, is an incredible cook and cooks these great, great meals, even though we're out there in the middle of nowhere. And they have a completely self-sufficient setup there. They have a micro hydroelectric generator. They have a river that runs next to their place, and they have a micro hydro generator and some solar panels, and that supplies all of their electricity needs. They even have extra electricity. They have to burn it off, and they use it to dry nuts and other things that Alex uses in her cooking. They have this beautiful bay right in front of their place, so you can go snorkeling there and do all kinds of kayaking and other activities. But literally, I mean, they're in the middle of nowhere. And Epi is a very undeveloped island. I think they told us that there are probably 6 functioning vehicles on the entire island, something like that. And they don't own any of them. They don't have their own vehicle. But it's a great, if you wanted to get away from the world and just sort of be in a remote area that's very beautiful and relaxing and stay with somebody who's a really, really excellent cook, the Epi Island Guest House owned by Robin Alex Crapper would be a great place to go.
Now, I'm going to guess if I stay there that I'm not going to be able to count on a fast internet connection then, right?
No internet at all. They have a satellite. And actually, as I recall, they did have Wi-Fi in the house. But it wasn't very fast. Rob's on Facebook. We're Facebook friends with him. And they do have email there. But no, it's not a fast connection. And they only have it on certain times of the day when the solar panels are able to gather electricity from the sun. But our reason for going to Epi wasn't just to visit Rob and Alex. It was to try to snorkel with a dugong. Because Epi is famous for having a bay on the northern side of the island called Laman Bay that has a group of dugongs that live in it. There's 6 or 7 of them there, and it's said that it's easy to go up there and snorkel with a dugong. Now, before I go further, do you know what a dugong is?
I don't know what a dubo is.
A dugong is essentially the Pacific Ocean version of a manatee.
Oh, so okay.
If you know what a manatee looks like, which most people do, mm-hmm. It's basically the same. It's the same size, the same color and shape, same temperament, and it eats seagrass. The only really difference between a manatee and a dugong is you'll remember that a manatee's tail looks like a paddle. It's sort of round, like a spoon.
Well, like a mermaid's tail, which is what many people think they were confused for.
Right. Well, the dugong is the same, except its tail is like a whale's tail. It has flukes like a whale or a dolphin. And so looking at them, that's sort of the obvious difference. And dugongs range from the Indian Ocean, sort of in the Arabian Peninsula area, all the way east to Vanuatu. And Vanuatu is really about as far east as you find them. But we wanted to go find one of those dugongs and snorkel with it. And that was our reason for being on Epi. And we stayed there for 3 days for that purpose. It involved riding on a wooden bench in the back of a pickup truck for about 2.5 hours each way over what I can only loosely describe as a road. It's just sort of a dirt track through the jungle, essentially. And we rode up to Laman Bay. When we got there, we went to a resort and hired a boat. It was a fishing boat. So it's a wooden boat that's sometimes used for fishing. So it's got all kinds of hooks and lines and stuff all over the bottom of it. We tooled around Laman Bay, snorkeled on some great reefs, and then ultimately found one of the dugongs and snorkeled with it for about 20 or 30 minutes. And there was a sea turtle involved as well, so we saw the sea turtle as well. But it was a real highlight for us to get a chance to snorkel with that dugong because we'd never seen one before, and we thought that was really cool.
Now, you had hinted before we started recording that one story you were going to tell involved a less than pleasant boat ride. This isn't that story yet.
No, that was at the first part of the trip on the Soren Larsen, the sailing ship that we were on.
Ah, okay.
The thing with the Soren Larsen is it's a sailing ship, and the theme of it is it's for people who want to learn how to sail.
Oh, okay.
And so they have an expectation that you're going to help work the ship in terms of raising and lowering and adjusting the sails, which is a lot of work. And we didn't have as full an appreciation for the amount and difficulty of the work that would be involved before we took the trip. Mm-hmm. And so we were on the Soren Larsen for 10 days, and a lot of the people who were on it absolutely loved it. They enjoyed it. They liked doing the work, etc. But from the standpoint of a vacationer wanting to relax, you're always sort of on your feet getting ready for the next adjustment of the sails or whatever you're going to do. And they also asked the passengers on the ship to stand watches. And so we were assigned the 12 to 4 watch, which 12 to 4 in the day is no problem. It's noon to 4 p.m. But it also meant that we were supposed to wake up at midnight and do a shift until 4 a.m. when the ship was underway. And it's disruptive of your sleep pattern, particularly when you're jet lagged. It makes it difficult to wake up early the next morning to do the shore landing that we might be doing at 8 a.m., for example. And we didn't think that was an optimal situation for us for vacation.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we mentioned that then, because some people that's going to be real attractive and others just cross that off their list. So we'll let you choose for yourself, those of you who are listening.
It is, to our knowledge, the only sailing ship that allows passengers or tourists that's operating in the South Pacific anymore. Because we believe it is the only one left.
I could believe that. I can't think of a counterexample off the top of my head, although it's a big ocean, so possibly there is one.
Well, our next stop after we finished at Epi, and we did successfully find the dugong and snorkel with it, was to head back to the main island just for one night, and then we were off to Tana, which is one of the southernmost islands in the archipelago. The reason to go to Tana is the volcano. The same volcano that I told you about that was on the Survivor TV show called Mount Yasser is there on Tana Island. So we flew into Tana. We stayed at a wonderful resort called Whitegrass Resort, which is near the airport, as I recall, on the western side of Tana. Lovely resort with small sort of villas right by the ocean. Great food, great setup. And we took two trips out to see the volcano, which was about a 3 or so hour drive over some of the roughest roads I have ever experienced. And I've been off-road a lot. And this was a very, very rough ride that you certainly would need a four-wheel drive for. But the reward at the end of that long drive, and you would make it sort of in the mid-afternoon. So you'd arrive at the volcano at say, 4:30, 5 o'clock, something like that. The volcano itself, as volcanoes go, is probably not that impressive. The mountain is not very tall. It's only something like 1,000 or 1,200 feet tall. And it's basically a big pile of ash. The entire mountain is just sort of this loosely packed ash because that's what the volcano emits. It doesn't flow lava like Hawaii. It's just, it belches out huge clouds of ash all the time. And one of the interesting things about approaching the volcano is you transition very abruptly from this thickly forested jungle area into an ash plain where there is almost no vegetation growing whatsoever, and it's like being in a black desert, essentially, because the ash is very dark black or dark gray. So you get this great view of the volcano with steam and smoke coming up out of it, and it's making noise every once in a while because it erupts essentially constantly, and you have this big, stark ash plain. And you drive over the ash plain and get to the mountain. You get to go through these gullies and things that have layer upon layer upon layer of ash that's been deposited over thousands of years, and you actually drive about halfway up the volcano, and then you climb the rest of the way, which isn't very far because the mountain's not that high. But the thing that is unique about Mount Yasser is it's the only place I'm aware of that you can actually stand on the rim of a crater of a volcano and watch it erupt from the rim of a crater. And that was a truly thrilling experience.
And with the ash in the air, there's not difficulty breathing? I mean, it sounds like there's some danger involved with this.
There's definitely some danger involved, and I'll tell you about that. But the nice thing in terms of keeping the ash and the gases and stuff like that off of you is there's a very strong prevailing breeze off of the ocean, and the side of the volcano that you go up and you stand on to observe it, you have a pretty stiff 15, 20-knot wind at your back, so everything's being blown away from you. So we didn't smell any gases. We never got any ash on us or anything like that. It was all blowing away from us. And it made the experience of watching it very pleasant. Now, having said that, there is some degree of personal risk involved. And it's because of the manner in which the volcano erupts. So what happens is about every 5 minutes, the volcano erupts. And what this consists of is it doesn't spew huge geysers of lava out or anything. It ejects these pieces of lava that range in size from maybe a small boulder up to maybe the size of a mini fridge, something like that. And it spews these glowing hot pieces of lava hundreds of feet into the air, accompanied by these gigantic loud explosions. And so the experience of standing there on the rim is like this. You're standing on the rim, and the first thing you know that one of these eruptions is about to happen is you can watch the shockwave move through the steam and ash that's suspended in the air right above the vent. And it's got two vents, and they sort of alternate. One may go off one time, another may go off another time. So you see the shockwave, then you hear it and feel it, and 2 seconds later, this huge number of glowing pieces of lava get ejected from the vent and fly hundreds of feet into the air, sometimes above your head. And so sometimes when it would do a particularly big explosion, you're sitting there thinking, okay, is this coming towards me? Do I need to run away? Because obviously if one of those pieces hits you, you're going to die. And one of the interesting things is there's a couple of guides up there who work for the national park that the volcano sits in. And they'll tell the tourists, here's where you need to stay based on the direction the volcano is exploding today, but don't go over to this other part. Well, several tourists ignored that advice and went over to a part of the cone where they weren't supposed to go. And it did a particularly big explosion in their direction, and a piece of lava landed probably 10 feet from where they were standing. Hmm. And there have been tourists who've gone to the mountain who did get hit by flying lava and killed. People were doing something very stupid. They actually climbed down into the cone to get a better view. Because from the place you stand to the vent is probably 300 feet, something like that. They climbed down to get closer and get a better view or something, and some chunks spewed out and hit them and killed them in the mid-1990s. But where we were standing, where the guides were telling us to stand, no piece of lava ever landed anywhere near us. Although if you go on YouTube, you can see instances of people standing on this rim and having lava land right close to where they were standing. So you've got to have a sharp eye out just to make sure you don't get hit by pieces of flying lava. But as far as I'm concerned, if there's not some risk of death, it's not a fun trip. So to me, this is very thrilling.
I'm someone who has stood close enough to the other kind of lava, not the pyroclastic flow that you're doing, but the one in Hawaii, the Pu'u'o vent, close enough to touch it and smart enough not to. But this one sounds like we're moving a little out of my comfort zone there, where volcanoes are unpredictable. So interesting.
Well, it doesn't. And what's interesting is you don't feel any heat coming off of it, because there's never a significant volume of lava that's coming out of the cone. It's just these pieces. But it is a spectacular thing to watch. And the cool thing is you stay on the volcano until well after dark. Mm-hmm. And at night, it makes for one of the coolest fireworks shows you have ever seen. Everything about the volcano is more interesting at night, because you can see the red pieces glowing and flying up into the air. And the whole ambiance of it is so much more interesting. And of course, there's no city anywhere nearby. The only light that you have is anything that may be coming from the moon, and then the glow of the lava as it's shot out of the volcano every 5 minutes. What's also interesting about this volcano is it has been behaving in this way for at least hundreds of years. Because when Captain Cook discovered the island and first charted it, he noted in his journal the very, what he called, troublesome activity of the volcano, and discussed that it would erupt every 3 to 4 minutes in just this same way. So even from 1774, when it was first recorded by European explorers, until today, the volcano is acting exactly in the same way. And I think that's pretty interesting.
Interesting.
But it was a big photography challenge for me to take pictures of this volcano, because my sort of number one objective for the trip was that I wanted to get some time exposures at night of the lava flying out of the cone, which I'm not used to. I'm used to doing wildlife photography, which is all very fast shutter speed, sort of reactive photography. This is totally different. It's tripod, very patient, be very careful about not moving the camera and all of that. And so I was really pleased with the fact that I was able to get some shots, some time exposures of the volcano exploding and putting on this very interesting natural fireworks display. One of the coolest things we have ever done, for sure.
And I'm a little jealous, actually, of the people who are watching the iTunes enhanced version of the show, because you actually have been seeing these pictures for the last few minutes, and I haven't seen them yet. So I will see them before you do, but I haven't seen them yet, so I'm looking forward to that.
They turned out pretty well. I was really happy with how it worked out, and I got to borrow some equipment from my father and from some friends of mine to get me set up to do this kind of photography that I'm not really used to.
Besides going to the volcano and paying attention to what the guides tell you, What warning would you give for people who want to recreate your trip and go to Vanuatu?
Well, understand that there is a relationship between getting to a very remote place where not a lot of tourists go and the availability and smoothness of sort of tourist experiences.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, you make the decision to go someplace really remote like that, you're necessarily making the decision that A, you're roughing it, and mm-hmm. B, things might not go exactly as planned. I'll give you a perfect example of that. So the day we arrived in Epi, we got there one day, we stayed at Rob and Alex's house, had a great time talking to them, and then the next morning they had arranged for one of the trucks on the island, again, one of the six trucks on the whole island, to come and get us and take us up to Laman Bay the next day to go find the dugong. So we're there. The next morning we're dressed, ready to go. We've got all our stuff packed, and they get a text message from the guy who owns the truck saying, "I didn't feel like going today, so I'm not coming." Okay. And there was no other alternative. So mm-hmm. we're stuck there at their house that day, which is fine. It's beautiful. They have a hiking trail and a waterfall near where they live. They have snorkeling right out in front of where their house is. And we amused ourselves with no problem. But that's an example of the way things can go wrong when you're in a place that is not visited by many tourists. And then, of course, you have the experience of sitting on a wooden bench in the back of a pickup truck for 2.5 hours each way to get where you're going. It's not exactly like a posh luxury experience. And so you have to understand that that's the trade-off for going to a place where last year fewer than 2,500 American tourists visited.
Hmm. So if you don't have some flexibility, Vanuatu is not the place for you.
No, I don't think so. And you have to have an appreciation for getting way off the grid if you go to a place like that. And we do, of course. We like that.
Oh, right. Obviously. Now, we talked about the surprise of that you're actually crew, not just passengers on the boat. What other surprises did you have on this trip? How about a pleasant one?
Well, the highlights that I told you about were all very pleasant surprises. I mean, the experience of diving the Coolidge was incredible. The joy of finding that dugong and snorkeling with it was wonderful. And the experience of the volcano and experiencing it two different nights, taking pictures and experiencing that sort of raw, awesome power of the volcano erupting right there next to you, those were incredible, unforgettable experiences. We also stayed in some resorts that we thought were very pleasant and very nice. So I talked to you about the Oyster Island mm-hmm. Resort on Santo, the Whitegrass Resort on Tana, and then when we went back to the main island of Farte for a couple of days on the tail end of the trip, we stayed at a really great resort called Aratap. It's about an hour drive away from Port Vila, which is the major city there. And when I say major, it has maybe 50,000 people in it. And all those were really great resorts, very great accommodations and great service. The other interesting surprise for us was an animal that we didn't realize was there, but learned about while we were there, and that is the coconut crab. Are you familiar with the coconut crab?
I am not familiar with the coconut crab.
So this is a creature that lives in the South Pacific, and it's a land crab and a pretty big one too. You know, they can weigh 5, 6, 7 pounds, something like that. The coconut crab lives by eating coconuts. And of necessity, that means its claws are strong enough to open a coconut. So they'll climb a coconut tree and they'll get a coconut and they'll open it. And coconut's tough to get into. And so they're nocturnal. They move around at night and they're very imposing looking little animals. And we had the opportunity to see several coconut crabs while we were there. And we were told always to keep our hands and fingers away from them because the claws are so strong. But I thought that was a very interesting find from an animal standpoint. The other interesting animal that you find, not just in Vanuatu, but everywhere in the Western South Pacific, are very large fruit bats. There are flying foxes everywhere in that part of the South Pacific. So you see them in Tonga, in Fiji, as well as in Vanuatu and probably other places too. And they're big. They have wingspans in the 3 to 4 foot range. And you'll see them at dusk flying back to their roosting places and nesting, sort of resting in various kinds of trees. And to get an up-close look at some of those bats, have them flying overhead, rustling around in the trees above us, we thought was a very interesting experience as well.
And I mentioned on the show before when we talked about Sydney, Australia, that in the gardens right there by the Sydney Opera House, they have several of the flying foxes, quite a large, I don't know what you call a collection of flying foxes.
I'm not sure either.
But my son and I thought it was very cool. My daughter and my wife were just totally grossed out. I mean, they're quite large. So they do make an impression on you one way or the other.
Oh, for sure. And then we saw lots more of them. We flew through Fiji to get home. Mm-hmm. So we stayed, I think, one night on Denarau Island near Nandi in Fiji. And that's a very upscale, touristy kind of area. And we were sitting there walking back to the hotel at night when all the flying foxes decided to come back and roost. And there were hundreds of them in the air, all coming back to roost in the trees on Denarau Island. Mm. And it was really an impressive sight. We loved seeing them.
And you mentioned flying through Fiji. To get to Vanuatu, it's not going to be a direct flight from your home in Atlanta, obviously. Are we talking about 3-4 segments to fly there?
It was Atlanta to LAX, mm-hmm. then LAX to Nandi, then Nandi to Port Vila, which is the capital city of Vanuatu, and then we flew on a turboprop up to Santo. So that's how many segments it was, and it took about 36 hours to get there.
Mm, okay.
That's why we decided to stay for a night in Fiji on the way back, to basically break up that really long trip, because it really does wear on you to be flying for 36 hours.
Right, sure. Well, and when you, at the beginning of the show, when you were mentioning Espiritu Santo, Holy Spirit, for those of you who can't translate that, but that reminded me actually of the show Baba Black Sheep, because this was set in early World War II, and they were a Marine fighter pilots who were always flying to and from Espiritu Santo, because that was really the center of the war in the Pacific there in 42 to early 43 during the Guadalcanal campaign. So
that's right. And the Black Sheep Squadron was actually stationed at the fighter strip that was right next to Oyster Island. Mm-hmm. Until they moved up to the Solomons, after the Allies took the Solomon Islands, they were based at that eastern strip on Santo Island, which is right next to Oyster Island, the resort there that I told you about where we stayed.
Interesting. So that the plane that you saw in the harbor may, in fact, have been something from that fighter squadron.
I don't think it was. I think it's a Hellcat rather than a Corsair. But they were, in fact, stationed there for quite some time. And there are pictures of them. You can actually find on the internet of the Black Sheep Squadron and Colonel Boyington posing there on Santo Island when they were based there.
Interesting. How did you plan a trip to Vanuatu? Are there a lot of resources available?
Not really. We always try to get an idea of what we want to do, mm-hmm. and then use a travel agency that is a specialist in the particular area of the world where we're going. And so that's what we did in this instance as well. We got an idea of the things and activities we wanted to do there through our own research. And there's certainly plenty of stuff on the internet to help you understand what's there and what's to do. And then we used a travel agent that specializes in the South Pacific, the same travel agent that had helped us with our Tonga trip in 2005.
Excellent. Now, one of the questions we usually ask, and I think it's appropriate for a destination this far from home, is when did you feel closest to home and when did you feel furthest from home?
Well, I wouldn't say I felt close to home at any point during this trip, other than when we were on Denarau Island in Fiji, which has a mall and a Hard Rock Cafe and a Hilton and a Sheraton on it. There's no place in Vanuatu that resembles anything like home. When we felt farthest from home is when we were on the Soren Larsen up in the Banks Islands, visiting villages that are reachable only by boat. There's no airport or anything there. Mm-hmm. And these are villages that might be visited by 50 tourists a year, mostly people who are sailing their own yachts, and they might stop over there to visit the village. And seeing areas with no electricity and really very little contact with the outside world, and being out in the middle of the huge Pacific Ocean sailing between these islands, it certainly gives you a separation, a feeling of separation from modern society, which is one of the desirable things about going there, of course.
Excellent. I've got four more questions for you, but before I get to them, anything else you would want people to know before they call their travel agent and book a trip to Vanuatu?
Well, there is certainly a specific time of year that you want to think about going.
Okay.
Just as there is a hurricane season in the United States from June through October, mm-hmm. there is a typhoon season in the Western South Pacific, and you want to be sure to plan around that. That essentially means going in the winter. We went in August into September, so it's winter there. Mm-hmm. Not that it's ever actually really cold there because you're so close to the equator, but there is certainly a season to go and a season not to go based on the threat of typhoons.
Excellent. When I thought about that question, I thought, no, we were talking about someplace close to the tropics that I didn't need to ask. So I appreciate you correcting that for me.
And that's true of all the South Pacific islands. A lot of them are subject to typhoons. And then, of course, if you're going to see whales, you want to go at that time of year as well, because that's the time of year that the whales would be there. It's the same in Tonga. And we actually saw quite a few humpback whales while we were in Tanna. We were sitting there in the restaurant at White Grass Resort, looking out onto the ocean and watching humpback whales swim by within 200 or 300 yards of the shore. It was really cool.
One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Vanuatu.
The language. One of the interesting things about Vanuatu is the language that they speak. It's essentially a hybrid of Pidgin English and French, and it's called Bislama. And they have these very, and you can, if you're an English speaker, you can read most of the words because they're similar enough to English words that you can sort of get them. Mm-hmm. So, for example, one of the very commonly used words there is blong, B-L-O-N-G, which is just a shortening of belong. And they use it as a way to connect words. So, for example, they have a beer that they brew there in Vanuatu called Tusker. And so they want to say it's our beer, essentially the beer that we brew here. So the way that they put it on the sign is it says beer belong you me, Y-U-M-I, which is you and me.
It belongs to you and me. Okay.
Yeah. You see signs everywhere that are in this language, Bislama, and it's really a very unique written and spoken language. And it's something that can give you a chuckle every once in a while because of the similarity to English words.
Interesting.
The other interesting thing about Vanuatu is it's said to have the greatest dialect density of any place on the earth. There's something like over 200 different dialects of the language that they speak there among the various islands. And remember, this is a set of islands that has only about 100,000 people total on it. And it has hundreds of different dialects from the different islands. And of course, the people there are Melanesian. They're ethnically distinct from the Polynesians that you'd find in places like French Polynesia or Hawaii or Tonga. They're Melanesian, which just means they're more like the people from Papua New Guinea, the Solomons, Fiji, places like that.
Okay. So you mentioned we're not going to a place with a mall. So one thing you should remember to pack.
Well, anything you think you need. There are stores where you can buy things on the islands that are more visited by tourists. So like Port Vila and Tanna and even Santo, there are little shops where you can buy certain things. Like Santo has three dive shops in it because it's a very popular dive destination. You can buy sunscreen and t-shirts and things like that in Luganville, which is the town on Santo. So it's not that you're completely cut off. And certainly when you're in Port Vila, it's a significant size city with 50,000 people. And it's got restaurants and bars and supermarkets and all the kinds of things you'd be used to in a regular city. So it's not like you have to be completely self-sufficient. But if you do something like we did, which is get on a sailboat and go up to the Banks Islands, you better have everything you need on that trip because there's definitely no place to buy anything. The one other thing I would warn people about with respect to Vanuatu is the kava. So kava, if you're not familiar with it, is a drink that is popular throughout the South Pacific. And it is not alcohol. It's brewed from the roots of a pepper plant, as I recall. And it has a chemical in it that is essentially a sedative. And people pound it out of the roots of this pepper plant and make a drink out of it. And it's very popular throughout the South Pacific. And it's commonly put in a bowl and people sit around and drink kava out of the bowl. The thing about kava in Vanuatu is it's thought to be the strongest kava of anywhere in the South Pacific. And so you can easily sort of overdo it when you go and visit these villages or go to a bar and drink it. We had tried kava when we were in Tonga a few years ago, so we weren't necessarily required to do it again because we didn't think it was that great. But a number of the people on our trip tried it fairly copiously in some of the villages that we visited, and they found out to their chagrin just how powerful it was a little bit later. And so if you do drink the kava in Vanuatu, be careful and certainly exercise moderation.
Excellent. Last two questions. Finish this sentence for me. You really know you're in Vanuatu when what?
When you see one of authentic cultural dances that they do. They have these great dance ceremonies that they do with these elaborate costumes and music to go along with them. And it is something that is really uniquely of Vanuatu. And the other thing that I would say in response to that question is to tell you about water music, which to me is also one of the most incredible things that you can see in Vanuatu. So this is a thing that's done by women there in Vanuatu. And I'm not sure if it's done anywhere else in the world, but I've certainly never heard of it. They go into the water together in a group of three or five or six, and they can make music by beating their hands on the surface of the water. Hmm. And the way that they shape their hands and the way that they strike the water, they can create high or low pitch sounds. They do it in unison and they can make songs out of it. It is one of the most amazing things you will ever experience, because the sound that they can make with their hands on water is so interesting and so varied, and they coordinate with one another so perfectly. And of course, it's fun to watch because they're sitting there in the water and you're hearing this cool music and there's water splashing everywhere. And it is something that is, to me, uniquely Vanuatu.
That sounds fascinating. If you had to summarize Vanuatu in three words, what three words would you use?
I've got to work the volcano into the submap. Because it really is the star of the trip as far as I'm concerned.
Interesting. Okay.
But I would say the three words that I would have to use to summarize it would be remote, unspoiled, and natural.
Excellent. Chris, once again, a pleasure to have you on the show and to hear about your travels to Vanuatu. Thanks so much for coming back.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciated it and enjoyed doing the show with you again.
After the show, on going to the south side of Chicago, I heard from Peter, who sent me an email that I've actually put as a comment on this episode because it has some great links. He says, with the mention of Stephen Douglas's tomb in Douglas Park and Pullman's grave in Graceland, I thought you should know about a website about cemeteries in Chicago, graveyards.com, Graveyards of Illinois. And then also about the stockyards and slaughterhouses, Armour is buried in Graceland also, and Oscar Mayer is further north in Rose Hill. I had to go to find a grave to find where Gustavus Swift is buried. And I'll bet many of you didn't know that Oscar Mayer was a real person. Also, Amy mentioned anarchist politics, and I thought about the Haymarket Memorial. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Haymarket riots, but this is a memorial to the people who were killed in those, which were labor riots that happened in the U.S. because of the bad working conditions in the south side of Chicago. And yes, Bohemians or Czechs as they are known. On the northwest side, there's a Bohemian National Cemetery. You mentioned your Danish grandfather. I searched the site, and there is a Danish cemetery in Lamont, but the site doesn't have much information about it. Peter, thanks so much. Actually, my great-grandfather left Chicago for the plains of Colorado and is buried there. We got more feedback on that show, but this show is already getting kind of long, so I'm going to cut this off and bring this to a close. Remember, I could use your help with a demographic survey that will help me sell advertising that will support the work of this show. I actually pay to put out every version of the show because I do pay our editor and usually make no money. Go to amateurtraveler.com/survey to help with that. If you have any questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Chris2X or join us in the Facebook community, facebook.com/amateurtraveler. And as always, thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cave.